This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Where do we get our political values? Are we born with them? Do we learn them from our parents? Do we acquire them from the cultural era we live in? The religion, the myths and stories we are told, even the TV and books we watch and read. University of Vermont Professor Jack Krasinski believes that fiction can be a powerful vehicle for forming cultural values and perspectives. And he believes that a generation steeped in the stories of Harry Potter will have picked up some of the values espoused in those books and the movies based on them.
Who are you?
Dobby, sir. Dobby the house elf.
Not to be rude or anything, but this isn't a great time for me to have a house elf in my bedroom.
Oh, yes, sir. Dobby understands. It's just that Dobby has come to tell you it is difficult, sir. Dobby wonders where to begin.
Why don't you sit down?
Sit down.
Dobby, shush. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you or anything.
Offend Dobby? Dobby has heard of your greatness, sir, but never has he been asked to sit down by a wizard like an equal.
You can't have met many decent wizards, then.
No, I haven't.
Do scenes like that one from Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets teach fans not to discriminate against those who are different from them? Or is this just a story? Let us know what you think. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Anthony Jack Krasinski is a professor of political science at the University of Vermont. His most recent book is Harry Potter and the Millennials, Research Methods and the Politics of the Muggle Generation. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jane.
So I want to just ask you first, because this is something that often gets people muddled, how you define the millennial generation. What numbers are you using? What dates?
Well, generational boundaries are a little bit fuzzy. The way I see generations is basically how people came, how the environment, the culture, the history, what was going on at the time, what that was like at the time people were, an age cohort was coming of age, in terms of becoming aware of politics, developing their views, and so on. And so the millennial generation, people born after 1982 to maybe those who are seniors in college right now, although, again, you know, the boundaries are a little fuzzy. I consider myself Gen X. I was born in 1961, and I think our president is a Gen Xer, but some people don't think we're Gen Xers.
Right. Some people would put you at the tail end of the baby boom generation.
Yeah, like that.
And some people would put millennials up to 2002-ish.
Exactly. Where you exactly define the boundaries aren't as important to me as looking at the historical and cultural influences at the time they start to become aware of politics. That's the key issue.
But if we're in some cases counting people who are 18, 19, 20 right now, they may not even have formed their political sort of opinions and really sort of set their ways yet. So are you just defining what they came of age in without knowing necessarily how they're going to react to those things?
Well, we really don't know where the tail end of the millennials are right now, partly because of that. So usually we get a little clearer sense of the boundaries further on in time as the generations move on.
So you looked at Harry Potter and said Harry Potter was obviously a big factor in the millennial generations growing up in the culture. What made you think, though, maybe Harry Potter had more of an influence on the culture than just being around at the same time?
Well, I've developed this interest in how people acquire their political views and values. And it's pretty clear if you look at what's happening in our media environment that a lot of the information and perspectives that people get are not just going to come from the news or from reading nonfiction books, that we are exposed to an awful lot of stories. In fact, that our culture is dominated by that storytelling right now. And that if you look at those stories that we consume, if you would, that there's an awful lot of politically relevant material in there. And that clip you play was fantastic to, you know, about the equality, issue of equality, about, you know, accepting people regardless of the differences, being respectful to them as well. Anyway, there are awful a lot of those stories, and in order to look at the impact those stories might have, or those lessons, if you would, might have on the people who read the stories, watch the stories, things along those lines, you have to identify things that are going to hit a large segment of the population, and lessons that are repeated are going to be much more powerful. And so my students and I sat down looking at the Harry Potter series. I actually set up a research class to look into this question first before the book ever came into play. And, I already had some ideas like, wow, the lessons over and over again about how you treat people regardless of differences, extending political tolerance, the fact that you don't use violence or torture, deadly force, or, you know, Harry Potter. Sorry if you haven't read the series, but he never uses the killing curse even against the ultimate bad guy.
Spoiler alert.
Exactly. Sorry. That came too late. But bottom line, there are these lessons over and over again. How you relate to authority is also key. That if someone was really immersed in the story and transported by the story and identified with the characters, we know from media communication studies that people tend to adopt those perspectives from that immersion, from that identification. And so those politically relevant views, we thought, might show up in fans of the series. And so the study we conducted was to compare those millennials who were fans of the series and those who were not fans. So we're looking within the same generation and at the same age group. And we discovered that those lessons appear to show up in the fans and not in the non-fans to the degree they do in the fans, even while controlling for a lot of other important factors that would predict people's views on these politically relevant issues.
Although we should say one of the factors you don't control for, or, you know, the sample size that you're using, these are all college students that
yes.
you're using. So they're all people who have gone to college.
Exactly. Although we have quite a diverse set of colleges and universities, including community college, including colleges in, you know, Mississippi, out in California. So we have... You know, we can't really generalize to the generation as a whole, but what we can do with the sample is look at the fans versus the non-fans among this group. And, you know, through several different pretty rigorous tests, we find that they do differ based on those lessons that pop up in the Harry Potter series.
Well, listeners, if you have thoughts about the lessons that can be learned from the Harry Potter series, if you think that fictional stories, things that really permeate the culture like Harry Potter did, can actually have an effect on a generation, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can jump on our Facebook page, the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Lots of people chatting there and on the VPR Facebook page. We got a note from John who says, look, the books are mildly entertaining, but the idea that they had some lasting imprint on our culture is pretty far-fetched. And Norlene says that the book's biggest contribution to our collective culture is great Halloween costumes. But disagree with them, Jack. You think that's not right?
Obviously, I disagree with them, and I encourage them to look at the argument in the book, and of course, trying to sell the book here. But anyway, to look at the argument in the book and the evidence in the book and the popularity of the series, people who aren't in the millennial generation, and a lot of this I got from my students talking to me about this, that underestimate the popularity of the series, how immersed this generation became in that. And, you know, I would just encourage listeners, think about the movies or the books that they read over and over again or really become engrossed in. Isn't in some way, aren't in some way the characters you identify, aren't they some ways models? We know from social learning theory, we know from socialization that we look for these models in our culture to demonstrate to us how to act, how to behave, that is the values we develop. And that... they don't have to be real people, and there's evidence to show, and not just in politics. Most of the
evidence,
don't
even have to be people, is what you're saying to it. Dobby the house
exactly.
elf.
They don't have to be people. They can be alien. They can be Vulcans. They can be, you know, whatever sort of character that we really identify with those characters, and we tend to emulate them. And you'll catch yourself emulating them in certain ways. And my point is, you also end up emulating them in political ways, not in any sort of overt sense.
But you see them, you see people reflecting the values they read in the books rather than the other way around, the books reflecting a culture that's already been established.
And in many ways, my disciplines ignored entertainment media because of the belief that people self-select themselves into the entertainment that they agree with. But if you think about how we're exposed to entertainment media these days, I don't think the self-selection plays as big a role as people say. And we know now from studies of the impact of the news that self-selection doesn't play as huge a role as we thought it did, that you have to look beyond that and look in more nuanced and complex ways that this entertainment media can affect us. I mean, the massive blockbusters, for example, like Avatar. How many people self-selected themselves out of going to see Avatar because of the environmental message there? Not many. All right, but they went. Amazing picture, 3D, all that sort of thing attracts people in. And then it works. And if these messages get repeated, then the question is, how do they change our views or shape our perspectives? And the other unique thing about Harry Potter is it hit that generation right in their formative years. Those are the years when they're just beginning to become aware of politics and learn about politics and the parallels to what was going on in the Bush administration at the time, you know, really reinforced that kind of effect.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the ways that you see the series having an effect on the culture. And let's first go to Anne, who's calling in from Middlesex. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi, we're very much a Harry Potter family. My daughter was born in 1990, and the first book came out exactly at the right reading age for her. But what I take from Harry Potter series, the entire series, is that Harry himself wasn't particularly bright. I mean, he had another character for that. He wasn't particularly talented. But what the story, I think, is about calling in your inner strength to meet your adversary, which is what he consistently does among all the books. And I think that's something that is missed, I think. I don't ever hear much discussion about that, but he's not using magic per se. Rowling is really using this magical world that she created really as a platform for showing a person able to get through all the hardships he's had and all the challenges he has to deal with, not necessarily using the tool of his hand, but his own inner strength.
Yeah, Anne, thanks very much for that opinion. Appreciate it. And let's hear from Jean, who's calling in from Williston. Hi, Jean. Go ahead. What do you think?
Oh, well, I think absolutely that values can come through from reading very, very much, especially when parents read with their children starting from a young age. My mother was a state librarian for a number of years, and that was her strong belief that children develop their values and the things they care about, empathy, from reading, and that children that don't have that kind of background to learn to develop those feelings, which they do through characters in good books, they're missing a lot.
Jean, thanks for your thoughts as well. So Jean saying, yeah, absolutely, we get values from what we read. And Anne saying courage is one of the values that she sees in
the
literature. And
a little more than courage. Yeah. I liked Anne's comments. We framed it a little differently in our conversations, my students and I, in speaking about that aspect of the story. But there's definitely a strong vein where Harry's not the typical hero. And he's not the individual action hero like in U.S. model stories, which is interesting. One of the repetitive themes in our culture is we wait for a hero to come along and usually with guns blazing and save the day. In the Harry Potter model, it's much more collective effort. So it's not just Harry. Harry never could have done it without his friends and the rest of the wizards who fell in behind him and the magical creatures and things along those lines. So there's definitely a strong lesson that, you know, it takes more than just one individual and even, you know, and that heroes are flawed. They're not perfect, if you would.
And let's dive into the politics here. We got a note on our Facebook page from Christine, who is responding to specific examples of moral lessons that can be drawn from the Harry Potter books. And she says, what about the lessons around educational philosophy and the effects of government control over curriculum and testing? When Professor Umbridge took over Hogwarts and banned all acts of practical hands-on learning and strictly taught to the test through textbooks, the students had to go into hiding to actually learn and practice.
That's another excellent example of that. There's actually a good piece that was written published in a law review magazine or journal, I should say, about sort of the depiction of government in the Harry Potter series, and that's definitely a good example. We tended to use Umbridge more as an example of what is known as an authoritarian personality, an anti-democratic personality, if you would. There's a lot of repetition in the series about why, you know, that is not a good model of authority and why you should challenge that model of authority. And so her activities in the school were a great example of that. And the best challenge, I think best depicted maybe in the movies, and maybe Harry Potter fans won't like me because saying the movies did a good job with it. But when the Weasley twins disrupted the the testing with the fireworks display and so on was a good example of defying authority when authority is unreasonable and overly oppressive.
And you see that reflected in the millennial generation through statistics or what?
There is a new way to measure predisposition towards authoritarianism, which is to actually ask about child-rearing practices. It has nothing to do with, I mean, there's no politics, there no political content in the actual question itself. And to use it on college students, what we did was we followed the model of a scholar who's done this before, where we just asked for a preference between word choices. And we found that's a very powerful predictor of people's predisposition towards authority. And we found that Harry Potter fans were less likely to be predisposed towards authoritarianism than non-Harry Potter fans using that measure.
What about in terms of voting? I mean, not all millennials could vote in the 2008 election, but when we look at the spread between and among millennials and other generations, millennials voted in much, much larger numbers and percentages for Barack Obama. Do you see that as connected?
I hesitate to say how much it's connected. The overwhelming support for Obama compared to any generation that I've seen in following these sort of statistics, as you know, I study elections as well. What I would say is what we're trying to do with this research is say, look, if you're going to paint a picture of all the influences that developed or shaped the millennials and in different ways, that if you leave Harry Potter out of it, you're just going to be missing a piece of it. Sure, you could predict a lot of what's going on, but I think you miss a very important part of this generation, the way they see the world. Everything I've heard from students who, once you talk to about this and you get into more qualitative kind of in-depth interviews with the students, is that they do come to recognize that this had a very powerful effect, and a large percentage of the generation identifies as fans and have read the books. One other important point I want to get through, too, is that we don't look much at this in political science, in specific terms about whether someone's a reader or not. We talk about, you know, cognitive abilities, things along those lines. But one of the factors that we controlled for was whether someone was a reader, an avid reader, before Harry Potter came along. And we also asked, you know, whether Harry Potter turned people into readers, because from my experience as a kid, I didn't like to read, and my parents were really worried. All I'd read is about baseball or whatever. And what happened was my brother brought The Hobbit home, and after that, I never stopped reading. And I heard stories from my students that that's the role Harry Potter played. It got millennials to read. We can't generalize from our sample how widespread that is. We found 17% of our respondents said they wouldn't have been a reader if it weren't for Harry Potter, which I think is rather huge. It's also corroborated by more general statistics on readership and testing, amount of time spent reading from a number of other disciplines, that this really had an impact on getting people to read. And getting people to read has an interesting effect on people's politics, because you're able to understand and handle the complexity of what goes on in our political world a lot better. And so Harry Potter had an indirect effect that way. So it's not just the direct effects, but the indirect effects as well.
We're going to keep talking about this. We're learning about the millennial generation and hearing from UVM Professor Jack Krasinski about his theory that Harry Potter helped shape the values of this generation. We're also going to look a little bit deeper into what are the values of this generation coming up. And we'd love to know if you see a connection. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or join the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're thinking about the millennial generation and what characterizes its members. Now, generational definitions are actually kind of squishy, but basically the millennials were born in the 80s and 90s. And we've talked for years about what defines the baby boomers, but what about this millennial generation? How do we define and delineate them? You can call in with your perspective, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We've been talking with UVM Professor Jack Krasinski about the influence of Harry Potter on these young people. And let's broaden the conversation now to learn a little bit more about some of the characteristics of this generation. We're joined as well now by Scott Keeter, Director of Survey Research at the Pew Research Center in D.C. Scott, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So you've been listening to this conversation. You see a connection between Harry Potter and the millennials beyond just that Harry Potter happened to be around while they were also coming of age?
Well, it's a very intriguing argument, and I think that Jack has explained why plausibly one could expect that such a blockbuster set of books that were read by so many young people in this generation and people in my generation, I'm a baby boomer, could plausibly have an impact. I mean, I would love to see more of the evidence, and I'd like to see the samples broadened beyond the college student group. But, I can certainly see how it would be. I mean, I think that Jack explained very well in the beginning how it is the generations come to be. They come to be because they share experiences that are different in, very often dramatic ways from the similar socialization experiences of previous generations. And while we think about that in political science as usually being things like who was president when you were growing, when you were coming of age, or was there a war, or was there a terrorist attack, or was there a depression, it's also very plausible that cultural phenomena, and certainly the publication of Harry Potter was a cultural phenomenon, can also have this impact during these years when people are figuring out who they really are.
Let's go to Matt, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hey, Matt, go ahead.
Hey, so you discuss a little bit about how Harry Potter, the series, relates with the millennials and how they relate to authority, and kind of like the negative figures like Umbridge and stuff. But throughout the whole series, Harry really has a complete disregard for authority, even for folks that are trying to put things around him that have his best interests at heart. He doesn't follow the rules. He kind of, makes things up as he goes along and does what he thinks is best. So I was wondering if you could talk about that in relation to even with, like, positive authority figures he doesn't really get along with.
Matt, thanks for the call. Yeah, interesting. Jack Krasinski, because, Harry Potter does have this enormous respect for some of the authority figures at his school at Hogwarts.
Certainly
Dumbledore is, obviously a person he certainly respects. But as Matt points out, he doesn't always follow the rules that even Dumbledore sets forth for him. So what about that view of authority?
That's a good issue to maybe take a look into. I'm not too sure how that would play out. We did discuss that in terms of it seems like Harry decides whether to follow authority, whether he thinks it's reasonable or not. Although sometimes, as the caller put, he defies authority regardless, even things that are put in place for his safety. That's another interesting aspect of the story. And as, the callers are starting to point out, there are a lot of these politically relevant lessons, if you would, in the stories. And the question is, how could they possibly influence us and, through what mechanisms? And back to Scott's comment about the sample size, I would love to have some help on that.
Yes, maybe there can be a collaboration between UVM and the Pew Center. Scott, what about, let's broaden beyond just authority figures, but what do you find so far about the millennial generation's perceptions of and relationships to corporations, governments? I mean, do you start to see themes emerging in how the millennial generation feels about government in general or big business?
One of the most salient features of the millennial generation in this era of skepticism and hostility towards government is how pro-government they are. I don't want to overstate it and say that the millennials love government in all of its aspects, but when you ask about the things that government does or should be doing, millennials tend to be much more pro-government than other generations. And, based on now a decade or more of data from the millennial generation, I think we can confidently say that this is not just a life cycle effect that is characteristic of young people, who are going to become more conservative as they get older. Now, they may become more conservative in some respects, but, they have remained pretty strongly pro-government, and they showed it by voting overwhelmingly for Barack Obama in 2008. And in 2012, but this is not an Obama phenomenon. This is something that began in 2004, and even though the turnout of young people and the millennial generation in 2006 congressional elections was not that high, Even there, they were the Democratic Party's best age group. As regards to business, though, I think one of the interesting things is that while they are pro-government, they're not anti-business. You know, we ask a number of questions over the years about whether business makes too much profit. They don't stand out on that measure from other generations. And they are not reflexively suspicious of business as you might think of, let's say, the baby boom generation, where if you find a political liberal in the baby boom generation, they're pro-government and anti-business. That's not as obvious a characteristic of the millennials.
If I could jump in on the point about government, it's interesting the way government's portrayed in the Harry Potter series with the Ministry of Magic. It's not portrayed in such a way that it would make you cynical about government, more cynical or skeptical about some of those who are leading government. And ultimately, Harry wants to be an aura and be part of the government, if you would. And definitely Ron Weasley's father works for the ministry. And so we explored kind of the differences between skepticism and cynicism, and we definitely found fans to be more skeptical than cynical, which is you want citizens in a democracy to be skeptical. And in fact, one other thing to throw in on that is to bring in other entertainment media. We know, including from work Scott's organization has done, that The Daily Show and The Colbert Report are entertainment programs that millennials tune into a great deal. And I'm working on another piece that trying to dissect the impact that has on the audience. And we found that fans of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, again, are more likely to be skeptical. That is, you don't throw everything out. You say, all right, let's take a look at this. Let's weigh the evidence. But there is some way to judge the reality here and whether someone's doing a good job or bad job, whether global warming's happening, things along those lines, versus the cynics who are like, well, everybody's just out for their own game. And that the fans, that the lessons The Daily Show and The Colbert Report preach are ones of skepticism, not cynicism.
You know, which is interesting because we got a note from Franklin in Johnson, who doesn't say what generation he's in, but I suspect he's not a millennial, because Franklin writes, "The millennials that I have had interaction with haven't been, for the most part, good experiences. They have very little respect for society, for their employers, their families, and themselves. As for them being less patriotic, it seems that they are well read in this country's rule over them by a wealthy elite, and have become ever so cynical about doing anything to serve that empire that benefits only a corporate elite that they will never become. Thus, we have the Edward Snowdens, who will act out without thought of protecting that corporate elite, which they see as quite different from the ruling class." Franklin goes on to say, "My question has to do with the overwhelming psychological impact of climate change, coupled with the loss of the American dream, you know, going to college, owning a home, retiring comfortably at 65. The millennials feel that nothing is within reach for them, so why should they care? You know what? I don't blame their attitude or their lack of patriotism." Franklin definitely seeing some cynicism in this generation. What do you think, Scott Keeter?
Well, it's there, but I don't think it's a defining characteristic. I mean, the fact is that this is a generation that has suffered significant harm economically. The net worth of people right now who are under 35 years of age is down over 50% by comparison with the people of the same age back in 1984. A lot of that has to do with the collapse of the housing market. And, of course, we know that significant numbers of young people are having to live at home because they can't afford to live on their own. And labor force participation is down, and unemployment is up in this group. And, you know, there are likely to be long-term consequences. But we don't see a corresponding growth in a rejection of everything as a result of this economic stress. I mean, I don't want to undersell this as a potential problem, let's say, for the Democratic Party in the future if it goes on. But we don't see quite that level of cynicism in our own polling among this group. And they tend to be very positive about things eventually working out for them.
You find that among your students as well, Jack?
I would definitely say that. They do seem to be more positive. And I think, you know, a couple of other influences, I think the technology of today, and I know Scott's written about this as well, that that might play a role in the sense that, you know, where do all those technological products come from? The caller or email talked about the sort of corporate elite controlling everyone. In some ways, I think maybe they see that as the battle of their parents. That was the past. That's not the those aren't the battles that they need to fight today. The battles they need to fight are something very different. And again, the fact that there was a boost in reading, I'm not talking about my survey findings, I'm talking about other studies, nationwide studies that looked into reading habits of youth, that there was a bump up in millennials and the amount of time they spent reading. I think that plays a role in making someone more skeptical than cynical. A cynical reaction is a simplistic reaction, after all. It's just, in some ways, it's a way to provide an excuse not to participate, not to read more, find out more. It's, you know, the elite control things, I'm not going to try anymore. There's no point in fighting it. That kind of cynical view is really defeatist. Someone who's more of a skeptic knows that's not necessarily the case and can see more of the complexities of what's going on in the battles of politics nationally.
We got a note from Richard Watts, director of the Center for Research on UVM, a colleague of Jack Krasinski's at UVM, who says, one interesting aspect of the millennials is that they're less interested in driving and car ownership than previous cohorts. Richard Watts says this is a good sign. And Ashley writes, in the final showdown between Harry and Voldemort, there's a key exchange about how Harry feels sorry for Voldemort because despite having lots of power, he's never known friendship, love, and true connection with others. In my experience working with millennials, they tend to value time spent with friends and family more highly than a salary increase. The whole work-life balance thing that other generations pay lip service to, the millennials write into their contracts. And Scott Keeter, you know, we started this program off with a clip from a Harry Potter movie talking with Dobby, the house elf, and looking at this issue of tolerance and equality and taking people with differences for who they are. Do you see that actually reflected in the millennial generation?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, first of all, keep in mind that one of the defining characteristics of the millennials is the fact that they are racially and ethnically diverse. You know, over 40% of millennials today are not non-Hispanic whites. They are Hispanic, they are Asian American, they are African American. And so they have a, you know, they have a natural respect for the kind of diversity that is becoming characteristic of the country. They tend to be pro-immigrant. They don't, you know, look at things as, well, I've got mine and I don't want anybody else to come in and take it away. And so in that sense, you know, it's very consistent with the past ethic of the country, but it's even accelerated.
That's Scott Keeter, the director of survey research at the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. Scott, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
We've also been talking with Jack Krasinski. He's the author of Harry Potter and the Millennials, Research Methods and the Politics of the Muggle Generation. He writes under the name Anthony Krasinski. If you're looking him up, we have a link at vpr.net. So much to think about here when we start to investigate Harry Potter and that book series influence on multiple generations, but most precisely the millennials. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Coming up, local tech innovators making their mark on the smartphone app market. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Vermont Center for Emerging Technologies recently received some high praise. The tech incubator was named among the best in the world at encouraging the startup and growth of entrepreneurial tech companies. David Bradbury is the president and fund manager of VSET, and he joins me now to explain what the incubator does and to talk about some of the innovative tech products that have been flourishing in Vermont. David, welcome.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So there's an organization in Stockholm that rates the success of business incubators around the world. It's called the UBI Index. And your organization was just ranked 11th in the world for effectiveness of what you do. First of all, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much.
And second of all, what is it that you do?
Yeah, what is it that we do? Well, thank you. VSET, the Vermont Center for Emerging Technologies, we're a nonprofit business incubator focused on next generation job opportunities for this generation of Vermonters. And we do that through facilities that we have. We do that through mentoring programs, through a lot of technical assistance, through some capital programs as well. And We were pleasantly surprised to see the efforts of all of our boards, our college partners, and the volunteers around Vermont who care about entrepreneurs here be recognized with this global ranking. It's really exciting.
And what they're ranking are things like jobs created per client, revenue generation, retaining university graduates in the region. Can you give us a sense then of what kind of impact you think VSET has had on the Vermont business sector?
Sure. I mean, I would say there's a number of organizations playing a part here, and we have a part here in the ecosystem. As I look back over the last, say, 6 years, the ecosystem for entrepreneurs has evolved here, and I think I describe it as we're in the fourth inning. Okay, there's a lot of game to be played left, but the momentum and trends are positive. I think in terms of impact, what seemed to carry extra weight in this global ranking was one, we do measure impacts. We have assisted over the last 6 years over 700 different startups and teams around Vermont. We have formally incubated and or invested in via our seed capital fund we manage in 36 companies. 39 million in payroll has been created here in Vermont. There's been $53 million in revenues realized by these early-stage companies, and there's been another $56 million in capital. So I think that's probably what carried some weight. And then the other number that I think really differentiated us globally was we work with 10 or call it 11 colleges and universities. We have a great relationship with UVM and Middlebury College, but we work with Norwich. We go up to Linden State to meet with faculty and students and get down to southern Vermont. So I think That's very different in the world.
When you talk about having assisted almost 700 startups, how many of them are still around?
Well, a couple of those they're probably on their third or fourth iteration of a business, right? You know, part of our philosophy here is we're trying to help train and mentor entrepreneurs. And statistically, you're not going to get it right the first time. You're more than likely to learn a little bit, hopefully make a pivot with the current business or regroup or at a later date reorientate your team. You know, I do say of the 36 lifetime companies that I mentioned earlier, there's still 24 of them in existence over the last 6 years. Some have sold, some are out of business, some are on sort of a permanent hiatus, I think.
But you don't see it as a failure if a startup doesn't succeed or continue for year upon year upon year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the world's changed. I mean, I don't think anybody's really trying to create 50, 200-year-old companies anymore. What we're trying to do is create an ecosystem where teams can come together, be great, excel at what they do, create a lot of revenue for the companies, taxes to the state, and then wealth for themselves, and then do it again. So, for example, we helped found a company called Here Forward a while ago and worked with them for 3 years. That was purchased by Dealer.com. The CTO of that company went. He's now CTO of another company. The four interns that were involved there, three have jobs, one's still in school. So you begin to see some sort of pay it forward ripple effect.
So one of the reasons that you wanted to come today was not just to talk about what you've been working on, but to talk about some of the tech entrepreneurs that are out there, ones that you've had a hand in helping and ones that you haven't, but you've been keeping an eye on. So let's just talk about a couple of them, and specifically let's focus today on apps. You know, everybody's crazy about apps and what they can do on their phone, and you've been looking at app developers here in Vermont.
Yeah, it is about the entrepreneurs whom we serve. A couple apps that I think are pretty neat as we see around Vermont. The first one out of UVM, there's one called GoCrop. All right, it's really a nutrient, soil, and crop management app where you know where to plant, where you did, and the history of that. That's a pretty interesting app that's put out by the University of Vermont.
GoCrop, I mean, that's a pretty niche app.
Absolutely.
So how do you make money off an app like that?
Sure. Well, maybe just more generally the app market, right? There's ones that are done for free. An app does it either because it's part of its mission as a college or as a nonprofit, or you sell them for what used to be probably an average of $2.99, $3.99 per download is really, you know, 99 cents to free.
These days.
Yeah, the predominance of apps are free, except where maybe you have some specialized utility to the end user or there's specialized content.
But in this case, that would be UVM is developing that because it's part of their mission.
Part of their mission, and I think is really a great example of how they're taking sort of technology that they have out of the Ag and Life Sciences College and translating that into a relevant contemporary farm setting.
Well, let's stay with the outdoor theme here and talk about another one that you want to discuss, Yonder.
Yeah, sure. A company called Green Mountain Digital down in downtown Woodstock, It's got about 13 or 14 people working there presently. The Vermont Seed Capital Fund, what we manage, has an investment in this company. They've got two apps of note. One is Yonder, which is really for the outdoor enthusiast. It was this group that realized, you know, a billion people on Facebook just lacked a little intimacy around certain subject areas and saw a business opportunity to really develop an app that inspired and enabled really a love of the outdoors to be shared around pictures, around places. So I arrive in Boulder, Colorado, and my app says, these are the six places to go. That's pretty darn exciting. And I guess for a comparison for folks, it's sort of where Instagram meets Yelp.
Mm-hmm.
They also produce the Audubon guides. So for anybody that's into bird watching, I think 2/3 of birds in North America are now migrating this time of year. So the Audubon Guides Birds app is a really neat one. And that one is, that one's charged for sure.
Yeah.
Yonder's free. The bird guide, is, I think, is probably $2.99.
And there, you know, there's one app that I have on my phone as well that's done by Local Motion, Trail Finder app. I mean, you can get a lot of these, depending on what your interests are, that are really specifically geared towards trails in Vermont or things that are in specific places where you are.
Absolutely. And there's another one coming out. I think it's a View Boost, which is really about back road adventures, right? You know, traveling down these roads and finding really what is the farm stand to visit or what might be the little waterfall or swimming hole to go to. And I think that not only helps our rural economy with our huge visitors that are so important to us, but puts it, again, in a contemporary framework and tool. And I think the challenge for a lot of business models is trying to translate into a form that people want to digest and can take with them, and it's the mobile phone. That's it. You know, another app that I think has been pretty interesting is iBank and iBank Investor. The founder is E&G Gillespie, IGG Software, and it's down in Putney, Vermont. He's got a remote global team of people, and this is sort of a quick in or a mint for Mac users.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of the top financial apps. It's been voted the best over time, so it's kind of exciting to see what, you know, four or five people can do very quietly. And again, join and participate in our local economies around the state. Another app that I'm personally looking forward to seeing, it's in private beta now with the medical system in the Carolinas, was developed by physicians at a North Country hospital who came to one of our TechAt networking events in Scrubs. And very independently, they've gone off and are really trying to solve the problem of medicine. Big thing to try and tackle.
Yeah.
And really, I just love how it was formed around the concept that people will be healthier if they get the right tools and the right information in the right form. So again, mobile, social, relevant medical information in a consumer-friendly format. And it's called Peachy. And it's being tested, and I hope it's soon to deploy here in this year. And I think, too, Vermont in particular, given the expertise around medical software that's here with, you know, certainly IDX and GE Health and a number of other companies, we're really poised. We've got the right talent, the right people to develop mobile applications further in the health sector. And I think, too, you know, there's a lot of speculation that this was 2013 was going to be the year that actually doctors would begin prescribing to their patients, download this app, right? Which I find my mind just starts to spin. But I think that's where we're headed.
How do you see that working in a place like Vermont where, you know, even though in a lot of places it can be difficult to find access to health care, compared to other parts of the world, we still have it pretty good. In a place like Vermont, where do you see the future of healthcare apps going?
I think it'll just become more and more embedded. You'll start with the light layer. It'll be around patient activity tracking, telemed tests, which is a UVM licensee company, rather than a notebook that tracks. You'll have an app that does that, and you'll have an electronic medical logbook. So that's one example. And through little small peripheral add-ons that, you know, where the headphone jack is right now, that's really a power cord for another small device. You know, you may be familiar with Square, like a payment, right? You can take a credit card reader, but, well, guess what? You also can put readers on that will measure glucose levels or some other data. It's a big Wild West sort of world right now, but I do think in Vermont we have entrepreneurs that have the right skills, the right motivations. So I personally think that's a big opportunity for investors and for entrepreneurs.
David Bradbury is the president and fund manager of VSET, the Vermont Center for Emerging Technologies. And we've been looking at just a small sample of some of the apps that Vermont tech companies have been developing. You can learn more about them at vpr.net. David, thanks.
Thank you so much, Jane.
And that will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, F-35s. The final environmental impact study on basing the fighter jets here was released last week by the Air Force. We'll take a look at the economics, the noise issues, and the community debate over hosting the F-35s in Burlington. You can comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon and 7. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.